My name is Howie Espenchot, and I'll tell you a little bit about myself. My wife and I have three children. We live in Atlanta. Our oldest, Rachel, is 26, and she's married with her husband, John. We live in Atlanta. She's a music teacher. Middle school. My wife's a middle school teacher also. Our daughter, Emily, just graduated from University of Georgia, and she lives with us, working a little job downtown. And our son, Ace, is 20. As a junior at Valdosta State. So that's my family, and something exciting happened with that one out there. Last week, my wife and I had our first ever grandchild. This is John Isaac. I was thinking, you know, I went to our daughter Rachel, and I said, you know, there's not a lot, they're going to call him Isaac, so there's not a lot you can do with Isaac from a sports fit standpoint. I hadn't thought a lot of, you know, great Isaacs in sports. His last name is Howard, so it's Isaac Howard. So I asked her if we could go Socky Howard, like Bill Rivera. I just thought they had Hall of Fame, or any kind of variation on Isaac. She actually liked it, which is scary, so I'm like, and now contrast that with the next photo, which you'll never see our grandson in this garb on Facebook. This is the three-month-old daughter of good friends of ours, Matt and Caroline, Atlanta. They are Georgia Bulldog fanatics. And for every home game, they have this setup and a message to the fans of whoever they're playing. Courtesy of their daughter. She has no chance. And if you're like, you know, there's a mixed reaction, you know, here probably to this. Some of you, maybe you live in SEC country and you think, man, that's awesome. And there's others going, give me a freaking And I tend to go that way, but we love those guys, and it's, you know, it's, you will never see my grandson on Facebook like that. I actually found Mockingbird a little over a year ago through Village Church Findings, which is in Atlanta. Our pastors write occasionally for Mockingbird, Kirk and Jonathan. And so I had been on the site for a few months and reading pretty much daily and really liked it. And February of this year, David Zoll put a request out on the site saying we need a sports editor, and if you're interested, send a related resume to this email address. And so I'd never written literally anything in my life, but I thought it would be cool. And so I sent him just like random sports background things about me, like I played three varsity sports at various level of success in high school. I'm a certified high school basketball official. And then the one I'm most proud of, I've played fantasy baseball since 1984. It was back when it was actually called rotisserie baseball. And I like to believe that I am one of the first 100,000, I'm pretty sure, that I am one of the first 100,000 people in the United States that played fantasy sports, which is now, you know, hundreds of millions of people. I like to think that I'm a kind of a high doctor. That was my big credential that I had sent today. And I got an email back within an hour and said, great, you got the job. Oh my gosh, I've never played in my life. So I had an opportunity to just write, you know, every week from February until the conference in April. New York City, so my wife and I went up there and had never met David Zoll, and walked up and just said, hey, I'm Howie, thank you for the opportunity, it's really fun. And you know, I said, thanks for taking a chance on me, I've never done any kind of writing before. And he said, oh yeah, you make really good comments in some of the posts, so when you email me, I said, yeah, take that guy, he makes really good comments. That's why I'm the sports editor. So this first clip is going to just be, you should see an affirmation that George Costanza is actually right. So go ahead and roll that.
was the last straw.
So what are you going to do now? You can look for something else in real estate?
Nobody's hiring now. The market's terrible.
So what are you going to do?
I like sports. I could do something in sports.
Uh-huh. In what capacity?
You know, like the general manager of a baseball team?
Yeah, well, that can be tough to get.
Well, it doesn't even have to be the general manager. Maybe I could be like an announcer, like a color man. You know how I always make those interesting comments during the game?
Yeah, you make good comments.
So what about that?
Well, you know, they tend to give those jobs to ex-ball players and people that are, you know, in broadcasting.
Well, that's really not fair.
I know. Well, okay. What else do you like?
Movies. I like to watch movies.
Yeah.
Do they pay people to watch movies?
Projectionists.
That's true.
But you gotta know how to work the projector.
Right.
And it's probably a union thing.
Those unions. Okay, sports, movies. What about a talk show host?
Talk show host, that's good.
I think I'd be good at that. I talk to people all the time. Someone even told me once they thought I'd be a good talk show host.
Really?
Yeah, a couple of people. How do you get that, though? Where do you start?
Well, that's where it gets tricky.
You can't just walk into a building and say, I want to be a talk show host.
I wouldn't think so.
It's all politics.
All right, okay. Sports, movies, talk show hosts. What else?
This could have been a huge mistake.
It was the last straw.
So what are you going to do now? You going to look for something else in real estate?
So, you actually can get a job in sports by making good comments. It happened to me. And now I can't quit my day job or anything, but the Mockingbird Conference has really good food. And you have come today for a session that we're calling Sports is the Greatest Reality TV. And David had asked me to do something, if I could think of anything, on sports as a breakout. And that's immediately where I went, was this line that I had heard Steak Shapiro, the top sports talk show host in Atlanta, say every week. He'd say on Monday morning, sports is just the greatest reality TV. And he'd recap something from the past week that really proved the point, that was larger than life, that was great story, whether it be even something awful or tragic like the Ray Rice or Adrian Peterson situation, whatever it might be, the drama plays out often real time, unscripted, live, unedited. And that is, again, like I said earlier here today, a breeding ground for transcendent moments. And we're going to go ahead and look at, and again, these are mine, they're not yours, but my transcendent moments in sports. I picked the top five, and we'll start with, before we go into the actual five top moments, let's run this next one. Before you hit it, let me just cue this up. This is a clip from the movie King Kong, the Peter Jackson version, where he and Ann Darrow have just reunited, and they have a little moment, transcendent moment, in Central Park. So go ahead.
Yeah.
that's one of my all-time favorite transcendent moments in movies. And really, it's right up there for me with where Emma Thompson finds out that Hugh Grant isn't married and her knees buckle in Sense and Sensibility. This moment's right up there with that for me. My wife loves that I'm a chick flick guy, and that's definitely a transcendent moment. And I go to a weird place with this movie and this scene. You know, they've got the Beauty and the Beast Disney story, and it's romantic. And some of the other iterations of Beauty and the Beast have been very romantic, but this one isn't romantic love, it's transcendent love. And if you see the movie, they come to that moment from a place where Ann Darrow has become King Kong's absolute significance. He's at the top of the food chain on a deserted island, the loneliest beast on the planet. And she becomes the object of his rescue, and he protects her. And so she is his absolute significance. It really plays out that way. And he becomes her absolute security. She's dead if he doesn't protect her, period. So they kind of culminate in that moment in Central Park, coming from that place. And the love that's happening there is something that we only get a picture or a taste of. It's a transcendent love that invades, that we get taste from time to time, but it's not normative. That's why I get excited about that scene. I've said that to multiple people, and sometimes people just look at me like, I don't see that at all. I really like it. So for the first of the five, we're going to go in ascending order from 5 to 1. My favorite kind of transcendent moments in sports. Let me preface this one. This is a mashup that was done the day after Kirk Gibson's home run in the 1989 World Series. It was done by NBC Sports back before mashups were even called mashups. You know, like two songs that were made together. And it's brilliantly edited. And it's a mashup between the Kirk Gibson moment and the final scene in The Natural. So go ahead.
Bottom of the ninth, A's 4, Dodgers 3. By the way, Gibson is not on deck. 3-1. And he walked him. And look who's coming up. All year long, they look to him to light the fire. And all year long, he answered the demands until he was physically unable to start tonight with two bad legs, the bad left hamstring and the swollen right knee. And with two out, you talk about a roll of the dice. This is it. So the Dodgers trying to catch lightning right now. Be an effort to run that far. Gibson was so banged up, he was not introduced. He did not come out onto the field before the game.
Roy, are you all right, fella?
Let's play ball.
Fouled away. But the game right now is at the plate.
Fly ball into right field. She is.
Bowl, the impossible has happened.
That's rarely been seen, I think, since. I never saw it again or saw it referred to, but I remember it. Now, all five of these moments are going to be ones that I actually saw live when they happened. That's one of my criteria. So much going on there for me. First, I just love that they're both left-handed, which is how that played out so well. Dennis Eckersley, the pitcher, went to my elementary school and my high school in Fremont, California. He signed the glove that I played baseball with from when I was 8 through when I was senior in high school. He was my guy, now a Hall of Famer. But played for the A's and some other teams. I was a huge San Francisco, and still am a huge San Francisco Giant fan. And so this moment for me to acknowledge him in my top five, some of you have that level of sports fandom that you can appreciate it, but I actually strained some friendships. When my wife and I were on staff with Camps Crusade through 1998, had some friends that were big Giants fans that I was on staff with, and I told them after that happened, I said, you guys, say what you will, that is just unbelievable. It's the best thing that's the best thing I've ever seen. And I almost lost them as friends. Because they said, the guy's wearing a Dodger uniform, that can't be anything but a horrific one. But I just, the whole thing, Eckersley, not only had he not given a home run since August, but that year he had what I think is now the second best season statistically for a reliever ever. Absolutely, and that slider he threw in that pitch was the unhittable pitch that got him those stats that year. And so that for me is such a transcendent moment, and then to put it in a mashup like that and kind of elevate it to really what it was, I hate to say special with his Dodgers, but it was special for me. The next two are moments for me because they're personal, because they happen in the context of community. And I think a lot of the sports moments that are elevated for us and they'll almost even become transcendent or gospel moments are moments that we experience with loved ones or people that share the love for that team or that situation like we do. And so these ones are, this next one in particular is a quick, smaller moment, but I'll give it context.
Time out that they shouldn't have it. It should be a technical.
They just got to throw it under the basket. Under the basket. Up.
Forrest shot.
Oh. Holy mackerel. Holy mackerel.
Thanks. That is Georgia Tech against USC in the 1991 NCAA tournament to go to the Sweet 16. And that was James Forrest. At the time, I was on staff at Camps Crusade, Georgia Tech. Huge Tech fan. We're watching that. You remember those moments where you know exactly where you were when they happened. And it was Easter Sunday. That was Easter Sunday. And I was watching that with my wife and her family and her extended family. And her dad was a Georgia Tech grad. He wasn't even in the room. And it ticked me off. And I remember that he missed it. But his brother-in-law was there, and we shared the moment together, and that is just rich for me and shared in a context of community. And we all have those transcendent moments like that. The next one, similar, but one that most of you are going to be familiar with, also happened in Atlanta. Well, actually happened in Atlanta. Go ahead and run that.
Room in right center. If he hits one there, we can dance in the streets. The 2-1. Swung line drive left field. One run is in. Here comes Breed. Here's the throw to the plate. He is safe. Braves win. They may have to hospitalize Sid Bream. He's down at the bottom of a
I redeem myself. Will just sometimes guess Will if he was young enough to remember that moment. Or old enough. That's Atlanta in 1992. I'm a Giants fan, but if you were in Atlanta in the early 90s, it didn't matter where you were from, you were a Braves fan. And I was in the basement of my house, one of our students that was at our expansion campus, Kennesaw State, that I'd been working with, was in my house in with me watching that game in the basement. It's pushing 1 o'clock in the morning when that happened. It was really late. It was a Sunday night, just the school night. It was a Sunday night. And when that happened, we made so much noise. My wife was sleeping. She came downstairs. We've been married almost 30 years. It's the only time I've heard her swear in our whole marriage. And she kind of opens the door in the basement. She goes, "Dude, what the hell?" And that's swearing for her. But, you know, it was one of those great, great moments where the most unlikely guy, literally people thought then the slowest position player in Major League Baseball at the time, Sid Green, scoring from second. And does anyone know who the guy it was in that was in left field that made the throw?
Barry Bonds,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Pre-steroids, so we don't know.
Skinny Barry.
Yeah. I don't know if that would have been better or worse. Yeah. But that, again, in the context of the community, that was special. And for the next one, it's going to run a little bit longer. It is a Sports Center highlights of the Boise State Oklahoma game in 2001, and it's literally the game ends and it goes again. This is another 1 o'clock in the morning moment, and so the game ends and it goes right to Sports Center. So rather than showing you the clip, I thought the Sports Center highlights of this game and what happens was pretty magical. And if you know the whole story, it's not just football; it kind of goes beyond it a little bit. So you'll see.
Oh, hook and line all in the pocket, you're gonna score.
This is SportsCenter.
What's good? Welcome to SportsCenter with Neil Everett. I'm Scott Van Pelt. Now, I like to say sports are better than anything else. My partner here likes to say recognize the whack.
And recognize what you're about to see is one of the wildest finishes to a football game ever. Fiesta Bowl, Oklahoma and Boise State. If Rocky Balboa were a football team, he is the Broncos. And, well, Sooner football is Apollo Creed, Clubber Lang, and Ivan Drago combined. And they've got Adrian Peterson back from the collarbone problem. Boise State led 21-10 at the half, but here it is late fourth quarter. Oklahoma down 8. Paul Thompson, Quinton Cheney. Oklahoma needs the two-point conversion to tie. And you're going to need to keep your head down for a while because here's the first attempt. The pass sails high. Oh, pass interference called on Orlando Scandrick. And Oklahoma going to get a second chance. And a second chance. Paul Thompson, same place. Jermaine Gresham catches it, but there's a flag for an illegal shift. One shot ain't enough, Jack. You better make it three. And on the third try, Thompson to Joaquin Iglesias. No flag. Game tied. We're going to overtime. But Jared Zabransky's got ideas about a comeback. Under 2 minutes to play, and he's going to want that pass back. Marcus Walker. And he's got reservations for 6. Ball game over. Oklahoma wins 35-28. Nice effort. But hold on, young fella. Final seconds. 4th and 18. Zabransky to Drizin James. Pitches back to Jared Raft.
Amazing.
ESU coach Chris Peterson said his backup quarterbacks told him to call this play. Yeah, call it's one thing, but executing it is a whole nother. The hook and ladder. We're tied at 35. We go to overtime after 22 points in the final 90 seconds of regulation. Oklahoma gets the ball first. Their first play, Adrian Peterson. 77 yards. And now it's finally over because Oklahoma, you know, they're not going to come back from that. And now, fourth down. Boise State, what are they? That's Zabransky, the quarterback in motion. That's Vinny Ferretta, the former walk-on wide receiver to the big tight end Derek Schumann from Eagle, Idaho. And then Chris Peterson says, we're going to 2-5. What's in the water in Southern Idaho? And on the two-point conversion, what is in this play? Zabransky behind the back handoff to Ian Johnson. And they said that because Oklahoma, they'd seen the play had they run it regular. And then Johnson runs over and proposes to his girlfriend. And she said, yes, Coach Peterson, how can you top this?
That again, that all finished about 1:15 in the morning Eastern time.
That's your top move?
That's the second one. That one just falls in the category of if this is a movie, no one would ever go see it because it would be cheesy and corny and no one would believe it ever really happened. There is so much going on here. 22 points in the last 90 seconds. You had a hook and ladder. You had the Statue of Liberty. You had Oklahoma making amazing plays. They had Adrian Peterson, Jermaine Gresham, probably their best team in this century. It was 2001. They were number one most of that year, I want to say, going into that game, too. Huge upset, but so many other things going on there. There was a rumor that went around after that that the guy who scored, I can't imagine this being the best day of your life, who scored the touchdown in that game, and then you got to fight your way through the crowd to find your girlfriend, who's the captain of the cheerleading team. He must have had this scripted out, so he can get him down on one knee, get her in front of the Boise State fan section, and propose to her. And there was a rumor that he had a secret compartment behind his knee pad where he had the ring. And then he pulled it out, and the whole thing. That wasn't true. It didn't happen. The ring came later. I'm sure that would have made the cut in the movie. When I see that, I always think about Rudy, and there's this moment in the movie Rudy that's kind of the watershed moment where Rudy's been the scrub player, best guy in the practice squad, busting his tail for 4 years, never even suited up for a regular game. And that week, Dan Devine, Notre Dame coach, says Rudy's not suited up again. The players won't have it, and you must have probably seen the scene one by one. They walk in and they put the jersey on the coach's desk. Their own jersey, saying, "Rudy doesn't play, we don't play." And the whole team comes through, and it's emotional, great scene. Never happened.
Right.
Never happened. Whenever Rudy's interviewed, he's invariably asked about that. Never happened. So I love when the moments that happen in real life get to a place where they're better than even sometimes the moments that we trump up in real life stories. So that's why that one's special to me. Go ahead and pull the next one.
Doesn't have a stolen base the entire season, so you're not going to run, you're not going to hit and run, you got to wait for a gapper.
That is fair, down the right field line. Giambi on his way to third, and they're going to wave him around. The throw misses, a cutoff man, shot into the plate, out of the plate! Derek Jeter with one of the most unbelievable plays you will ever see by a shortstop. Both cutoff men were missed. Jeter coming down the line, fielded with his bare hand, a shovel to Posada, and Giambi is out. What an unbelievable play by Jeter. Still 1-0 Yankee. Wow.
Doesn't have a stolen base.
It's a smaller moment even compared to some of the other ones. It's third or fourth inning and a playoff game. But the Yankees go on to win that series. But it defies logic that if you know baseball, there's in that situation a line drive into the right field corner, you set up a primary and a secondary cutoff. The primary cutoff is going to be the second baseman, and then if necessary, the secondary cutoff is going to be the first baseman further down the line. Because it's so far in the corner, it's literally the farthest place to throw from, from the outfield to home plate is the right field corner in most stadiums. And Roberto Clemente is allegedly the only person that can do it on the fly consistently. But so that's what you had there, and the right fielder overthrows the primary and the secondary cutoff. Derek Jeter's not, I mean, in any universe where they have Yankee baseball practice, Derek Jeter, the shortstop, is not supposed to be anywhere near that situation. But if he's not there, that run scores. The throws off line, it's up the line, the catcher would have had to come over here and then come back, and even Jeremy Jolly slow would have been safe. And it's just, you know, I think what I love about that is the humanity of the moment. Derek Jeter just retired arguably the greatest Yankee, a lot of people say. So the greatest player on the greatest team of all time, arguably. But it's such a human moment. It's something that's just heads up. It's just heads up. Something I would love to think that I would have thought of if I was playing. I could actually, it didn't take athletic ability or physical talent. It was mortal. It was human. But it was spectacular at the same time. And the bare hand, the one-handed foot. And just for me, it's perfect. It's an echo. It's a taste. I go to weird places with it. I know. Pull up that Word document there. This is where I go with it. In The Reason for God, the book by Tim Keller, he talks about beauty as a proof. The argument from beauty as a proof for the existence of God. And he quotes Leonard Bernstein, who in the 40s at the time was an agnostic skeptic, but becoming more and more open to the idea of God because of Beethoven's Fifth. And here's what he says. This is Keller quoting Leonard Bernstein. Beethoven turned out pieces of breathtaking rightness. Rightness, that's the word. When you get the feeling that whatever note succeeds the last is the only possible note that can rightly happen at that instant, in that context, then chances are you're listening to Beethoven. Our boy has the real goods, the stuff from heaven, the power to make you feel at the finish something is right in the world. There is something that checks out throughout, that follows its own law consistently, something we can trust that will never let us down. That's Derek Jeter now. Our boy has the real goods. That's where I go with that. I'm not a Yankee fan, but you watch something like that and you say that we're made for something else, and that transcendent moment really speaks to it. That's why for me, even though it's just a kind of a run-of-the-mill in some ways defensive play, it just boggles my mind. And so that's where I go with that. And after I had kind of thought about what the five moments would be for me, one of the recurring themes there was in every one of the five, and I didn't realize that until after I compiled them, was that they're down. In each scenario, the team is down. In some cases, they come back and win. In that case, they came back and tied. But there's a wrong. They're down. There's a bad throw. There's a interception in the Boise State game. There's a wrong that needs to be made right. There's something in us that loves to see wrong made right, even in sports. And players, people rising to the occasion to take something that was messed up, an errant throw, and make it right. And it even goes for me, again, I go a little too far with it, but even in Revelations 21, we're made for a place where everything will be made right. And for me, some of the great moments, gospel moments in sports, are that. So those are the five. I also just wanted to close with this quote from Matt Chandler, who you might know as the Village Church in Dallas. And he is fond of saying that the biggest worship service in the United States in the fall, four Sundays, is in AT&T Stadium in Dallas, because it's the biggest stadium in the NFL, and it's always filled with capacity. So he calls that the biggest worship service on a Sunday for 8 days in fall in our country. He doesn't mean that positively.
Right.
He's referring to idolatry, and the talk is talk about idolatry. So for discussion, we've talked a little bit about where I think in worship with transcendent moments and story as they relate to sports. But there's a line crossing, and I live in SEC country, and that's kind of the mothership for line crossing in terms of fanaticism, some would say, with the LSU guys, not his head back there. And so, just in closing, and in your questions and your comments, any thoughts you have on that as to where that line is? What can we worship? I mean, is this worship real worship? Is it silly? Is it idolatry to consume sports? And where is that? We'll break or stop there. And just open these questions.